President Trump prepares to impose new sanctions on Iran as Iran threatens to shoot down more U.S. spy drones. Today is Monday, June 24th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, the increasing tensions with Iran. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. is willing to talk with Iran.
I am confident that at the very moment they're ready to truly engage with us, we'll be able to begin these conversations.
Also this hour, the White House plans to unveil the economic arm of its Middle East peace plan, and the first Boston-area casino opens for business in Everett.
Well, you know, it's pretty exciting because it's, my understanding, it's a Las Vegas environment. So, yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Sports: Red Sox lose to the Blue Jays again. Forecast: sunny skies, around 80 today. It's 7:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has arrived in Saudi Arabia for discussions about Iran. Last week, President Trump says he called off a military strike on Iran after Tehran shot down a U.S. military drone. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the U.S. has also imposed new sanctions on Iran.
Secretary Pompeo also said that 80% of the Iranian economy is sanctioned, and what they want to do is kind of turn the screws a little bit more on the economy. But it is also true that some of those sanctions and some of those penalties that they've put on the Iranian economy have not been in effect for so long. When they reinstated the sanctions, that has been only about a year. They also implemented new oil penalties, trying to prevent many different countries from buying Iranian oil.
NPR's Franco Ordonez. South Bend, Indiana mayor and Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg attended a jammed town hall meeting on Sunday where he faced angry community members. From member station WVPE, Justin Hicks reports the meeting was held following the fatal police shooting of a black man.
The town hall was organized by the mayor's office 1 week after the police shooting of 53-year-old Eric Logan. Activists repeated demands for a federal investigation and the firing of several officers along with the chief of police. Buttigieg says he will support a Department of Justice investigation, but can't fire officers and won't ask the chief to resign. He promised transparency in the investigation.
Our intention will be to release as much information as we legally can as quickly as possible.
Tensions are still high in South Bend. Sunday morning, a civilian shooting of at least 10 people resulted in an angry mob at the hospital. Buttigieg says he still plans to participate in the Democratic presidential debates Thursday evening. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks.
The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to announce a new round of decisions this morning in some major court cases. NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports one of the rulings could be on whether the Trump administration can add a citizenship question to the upcoming 2020 census.
The Trump administration says it wants to better enforce the Voting Rights Act by adding the question, is this person a citizen of the United States? But courts are reviewing allegations that that was not the real reason for the question. Critics worry it will discourage non-citizens and some citizens from taking part in the headcount of every person in the U.S. If the courts allow the question, some Democratic presidential hopefuls, including Senator Amy Klobuchar, are calling for a redo of the 2020 census if there's a significant undercount.
We will have to have a recount if the Supreme Court persists in including this question on there.
In Congress, lawmakers are considering a spending bill that would not fund a citizenship question. Anzi Luong, NPR News, New York.
The National Weather Service is warning strong to severe storms may strike the eastern U.S. today from the Ohio Valley to the mid-Atlantic. Main threats are damaging winds and heavy rain. You're listening to NPR.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. Almost one-third of Massachusetts residents say they have trouble paying for their prescription medication. WBUR's Deborah Becker reports on a new WBUR poll.
The poll indicates that many people do things like skip taking their prescription medications or cut doses to make them last longer because of cost. Steve Cazella with Mass Inc. Polling Group, which did the poll for WBUR, found that surprising.
We in Massachusetts are a state with almost universal health insurance coverage. But when you start asking about problems that people are encountering, you know, then you start to get a bit of a different picture.
The poll of more than 600 Massachusetts residents was conducted last month. It has a margin of error of 3.8%. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker.
Authorities say a man wanted for a murder in North Attleboro was found dead last night in Rhode Island. The Essex County District Attorney's Office says 32-year-old Stephen Fregioli shot and killed 37-year-old Brandy Berg Saturday night. Investigators believe Fregioli died by suicide. The former brother-in-law of former Governor Deval Patrick is scheduled to be sentenced today for rape, kidnapping, and stalking. 67-year-old Bernard Tsai was also found guilty of violating a restraining order and witness intimidation. He could spend more than 20 years in prison. A new round-the-clock bus lane opens today, connecting Oak Square in Brighton with Packard's Corner. The lane runs along the eastbound side of Brighton Ave and will be open to cyclists. Here's Greg Rooney, the Interim City Transportation Department Commissioner.
Residents, businesses, commuters, public officials had been advocating for something to help improve this critical connection that had been lost years ago when the A line had been discontinued.
Rooney says 14,000 bus riders use that section of Brighton Ave each day. It's 7:06.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Jacob and Valeria Langloth Foundation, supporting the health and well-being of underserved populations at langloth.org.
Sports: Red Sox lost to the Blue Jays 6-1 yesterday at Fenway, dropping 2 out of 3 in the weekend series. Red Sox host the Chicago White Sox starting tonight. Team USA plays Spain in the Women's World Cup this afternoon. It's the round of 16, so the winner advances and the loser goes home. There will be a watch party for the game at noon today on Boston City Hall Plaza with a big screen TV. Traffic: 495 north in Tewksbury, there is a crash after Route 38. The Mass Pike eastbound in Millbury, there is a crash after exit 10A, causing a 6-mile backup. And 93 north is 40 minutes now from the Braintree Split to Columbia Road. Forecast: warm this week every day except tomorrow. Sunny today, mid-70s to mid-80s today, coolest along the shore and on the Cape and the islands. Around 60 tonight and partly cloudy. Tomorrow showers, possibly a thunderstorm, just in the low 70s Tuesday. Sunny in the low 80s on Wednesday, then in the upper 80s and sunny both Thursday and Friday. In Boston now, 69 degrees, 61 in Worcester, 65 in Gloucester, and 66 degrees in Newburyport at 7:07.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. The U.S. may have decided against military action against Iran, at least for now. But according to reports this weekend, President Trump did authorize cyber attacks in retaliation for a downed U.S. drone. Yahoo News was the first to report the cyber strikes. The Pentagon, though, is not confirming it. But the U.S. Department of Homeland Security did release a statement saying that Iran has stepped up its cyber targeting of U.S. industry, including oil and gas companies. Christopher Krebs signed that statement. He is director of DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency and joins us now on the line from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Good morning.
Good morning. So before we get to the cyber threat coming out of Iran, and I do want to talk about that, can you explain the scope or objective of the reported U.S. cyber action against Iran that have been widely reported?
So I think that's probably a question better suited for the Department of Defense. My organization, and the reason we sent that statement out, was to let the American people know that, hey, times are interesting right now. We are seeing an increase of malicious cyber activity out of Iran, and everybody needs to be on alert.
Iran says, though, that this was an attack. This was a cyber attack against its missile control systems. Granted, they say the U.S. operation failed, but implicit in that statement is that some kind of attack did happen.
Well, I tell you what I see, and that's talking to a number of private sector cybersecurity companies in the U.S. I can tell you what we see from where we sit at the U.S. Cyber Agency and some of the targeting of U.S. agencies, U.S. critical infrastructure. And there's no question the last couple of months, the Iranians have been more active. Over the last several weeks, that activity increased even further. But really in the last week, we saw a significant increase in targeting by Iranian actors of U.S. agencies, U.S. industry. And it was imperative that we shared that information with the American people
and
to make sure that they're on the lookout.
I absolutely want to get to that. I just, for clarity's sake, are you saying that you cannot talk about the reported cyber attack or that it didn't happen?
Again, that's a question better suited for the Department of Defense.
Got it. So let's talk about the threat as you see it coming out of Iran. What does the malicious activity look like? I mean, what are, we mentioned oil and gas companies. Are there actual cyber attacks that are being levied against oil and gas companies in the U.S., or is this just the imminent threat?
So we're seeing a couple tactics. I mentioned that in my statement, things like spear phishing and password spraying and credential stuffing, fully recognizing that these are, you know, kind of terms of art in the information security world. But it's basically what they're trying to do is gain access to networks, get you to click on that link or get you to click on the attachment in an email. And then that gives them access to the network. And then at that point, they can do whatever they want. We've historically seen folks being worried about data breaches and release of sensitive information. These actors are different. Yes, they're looking to collect information, but these actors have showed destructive tendencies in the past. I think that probably every person listening right now, in some way, shape, or form, whether it's at a local level, local government level, state government level, has been affected by a ransomware attack. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about folks getting in there and locking up networks, burning down networks, so that information is not just released, it is gone. Those networks have to be built from the ground up. And this costs people money. This really affects services at the local level. So we just want people to be aware that, you know, any little thing could turn into really a really bad thing.
Mm-hmm. What's the goal? I mean, when you look at these cyber attacks, do you have any idea what the larger motive is?
Well, they could have a number or a range of motives or interests. First, in the more traditional, is just collecting intelligence. The Iranians have been pretty active in collecting information about oil and natural gas so that they can boost their own oil and natural gas industries. They're also looking for information from U.S. agencies or what we might be doing. You know, what is the Treasury Department thinking about sanctions? What is the Department of Defense thinking about their own activities? So the baseline level is espionage. But again, these are actors that, unlike almost any other nation state actor, has been the most active in the destructive data deletion, ransomware, lock them up. Department of Justice last year indicted two Iranian actors for the SAMSAM ransomware campaign. Again, that hit Atlanta. That hit a couple other cities.
Uh-huh.
These are guys that go in there. They take data. They lock it up. And you never see it again. So we just want people, again, be on the lookout for phishing emails in particular.
Who are the guys? When you say these are the guys who are doing this, how connected are they to the governing regime?
So at a certain point, it doesn't matter because there are intelligence agencies that use a number of different structures. They have contractors. They have things called proxies and cutouts and. It is they're acting on behalf of the Iranian government, and again, as a U.S. government, we have a number of different tools and levers of power that we can use, and we've done that historically, and we'll continue to do that. But the American people, they have a role in this too. You know, protect yourself, protect your networks. If you see something, say something, let us know.
Larger political question. You are a political appointee in the Trump administration, so I'm going to ask this broader question about criticism being levied at this administration for reportedly playing up risks from Iran to justify more aggressive action. What do you say to that?
I don't think that's the case. Whether it's Iranian actors, I think Chinese actors, Russian actors, it's an active landscape right now. And I think over the last 15, 20 years, we've lost sight of the fact that there's a peer and near peer power competition playing out across the world. And we've got to step our game up. In particular, I think, again, folks, keep a lookout on what's going on out there. Keep a lookout for suspicious emails.
Everyone
and
can play a
role. Don't click that link if you don't know what it is.
Understood. Chris Krebs.
Yep, everybody's got a role here.
Chris Krebs of DHS. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
The new president of Brazil has been in office a little less than 6 months. Many people saw the election of Jair Bolsonaro as a challenge to democracy itself. He comes from the far right. Some of those fears have not proved justified yet, but many Brazilians see him as a threat to their rights, and many were in the streets yesterday of Sao Paulo. NPR's Philip Reeves was there, too.
This is one of the biggest gay pride parades in the world. Hundreds of thousands of people are here. Sao Paulo's held this event every year for more than two decades. Alif Shesika's a gay man of 25 who's come in drag. He says this year's parade's different because of one man, Jair Bolsonaro.
And the time Bolsonaro came in power, a lot of rage, a lot of fear of the unknown, of the different came out. You know, the people that were violent, they came out of, you know, of the closet as well. So now they have this rage against us. So it's different.
This parade looks like a massive party, a vast and joyous gathering of exotically clad people, flourishing the rainbow flag, drinking and dancing all day long. Yet stop and talk to people, and you'll hear how much they worry. Karina Musa is here to support her son, who's 25 and gay.
And you worry about his security?
Yes, of course, and for all the others.
And do you worry more now than you used to before?
Yes, I do, because of the government. So I feel ashamed.
Bolsonaro once said he'd rather have a dead son than a gay one. That was before he became president. In office, he's declared he doesn't want Brazil to be a gay tourist destination. He's also made disparaging comments about a leading gay activist, calling him a girl. Bolsonaro's supporters tend to say these are just words to shore up his conservative base. Yet LGBTQ Brazilians are frequent targets of violence and stigma. 141 were killed in attacks or committed suicide from January to mid-May this year, according to Grupo Gay Bahia, which monitors this type of hate crime. Words are dangerous here, says Bruno Marco, who's 33.
And this kind of speech is gaining force, is getting stronger. And we have to stay here on the street just to say, no, you are not right. We have rights and we are here for the rights.
In the month after Bolsonaro was elected, but before he was sworn in, same-sex marriages in Brazil rose by about two-thirds. Gay Brazilians said they wanted to marry quickly in case they lost the right to do so. Here in Sao Paulo, some held mass weddings. Yet Bolsonaro's government has struggled to get anything much done on any front. For Fabio Zanini, it's been
chaotic, confused, very unpredictable.
Zanini's editor-at-large with A Folha, a leading Brazilian newspaper.
This is a government that has a lot of internal fighting. We have literally a crisis on a weekly basis.
Bolsonaro's latest crisis features his justice minister, Sergio Moro. Moro was a judge. He won worldwide fame by campaigning against corruption and jailing politicians and executives embroiled in Brazil's car wash investigation. Last year, Moro dispatched to prison Bolsonaro's biggest rival, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, Lula, as he's known by everyone. Now Intercept, an investigative website, says it's acquired leaked materials showing Moro collaborated with prosecutors to fast-track Lula's conviction and stop him from running in the election that Bolsonaro won. Moro denies it. Back at the Gay Pride Parade, people are celebrating the Intercept allegations as a blow to Bolsonaro. They're also celebrating something else. The other day, Brazil's Supreme Court criminalized discrimination against homosexuals and transgender people. Bolsonaro called that ruling wrong. For Alif Shesika, the ruling is a big deal.
It is, because it took a long time for us to get that. It was a struggle for many years.
Yet, he adds,
we feel like we're still fighting. This is like a tiny victory, but still in a war. We're still in a war against this president.
Philip Reeves, NPR News, Sao Paulo.
And here's a story we're following for this afternoon on All Things Considered. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrives in India, another possible front in the Trump administration's trade wars. Tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
I'm Dawn Brosh, a Bunch of Grapes bookstore. WBUR is on the Cape and Islands at 89.1 and 92.7 FM and always on the WBUR Listen app.
Just ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, the slot machines are ringing out this morning after the weekend opening of the new casino in Everett. Then in 20 minutes, an update on President Trump's campaign promise to lower prescription drug prices. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Children's Hospital, named the number one children's hospital in the nation by U.S. News & World Report for the sixth year in a row. Boston Children's, where the world comes for answers.
Now the forecast, a pretty nice week ahead. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
It will be tough to work today with all the sunshine out there. Temperatures in the upper 70s to low 80s, a little cooler in the afternoon right along the coast. Partly cloudy tonight, either side of 60 degrees, dry. Tomorrow, showers and some thunderstorms around the area. Temperatures only in the lower 70s. You'll feel that humidity creeping up. And it's with the sun Wednesday, partly sunny. We're in the low, perhaps middle 80s, maybe a shower early, but it definitely feels like summer. Thursday and Friday, 85 to 90 degrees, cooler. Cape and the Islands, a blend of clouds and sun.
In Boston now, 70 degrees. This is WBUR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Our series of conversations with 2020 presidential candidates continues with Colorado Senator Democrat Michael Bennett.
Mitch McConnell and the Freedom Caucus have tyrannized the American people. They have immobilized our national government. Our exercise in self-government has been destroyed by them, and we have to overcome them.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Jones Day, an integrated partnership collaboratively providing legal services for more than a century. 43 offices, 5 continents, serving clients as one firm worldwide. Learn more at jonesday.com. The Annie E. Casey Foundation, marking 30 years of tracking child well-being nationally and state by state with the Kids Count Data Book and Data Center. Learn more at datacenter.kidscount.org. And Teradata, committed to transforming the way business works through the power of data. Teradata leverages data across the enterprise on a single platform to deliver answers to today's complex business issues. Teradata.com.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. The only casino in the Boston area is now operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thousands turned out for yesterday's grand opening of Encore Boston Harbor's building along the Mystic River in Everett. Political leaders are hoping the massive resort and casino will give a jolt of economic development in what's called a lackluster part of Everett. WBUR's Simone Rios reports.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Of the 50,000 people expected on the first day, Therese Gray of Cambridge might have been the only one who was so excited she cried first thing in the morning.
You see this sign?
What does it say?
It says Encore, win big, June 23rd, 2019, Everett, Mass. I'm here to win big.
What are you going to play?
Slot machines.
And you got a lucky $1 bill attached to it.
That's a lucky $1 bill.
Is that what's going to make the difference?
God's going to make the difference. How's that?
Officials say the opening of the Wynn Resort's $2.6 billion Encore Boston Harbor is a turning point for the city of Everett. Mayor and major casino booster Carlo Di Maria got choked up at the podium as he thanked his family for their support. Now Di Maria says the Wynn Resort is going to help further transform this ragged industrial area on the Mystic River.
When you drive through Everett, you'll no longer smell gas and sulfur and oils. But you'll smell flowers and trees. We will no longer be the back door to the city of Boston. We will now be the front door to the city of Everett.
That rings true for Linda Maloney of Everett Rising. The group campaigned in favor of the casino in a local referendum that won by a nearly 9-1 margin.
I think just, you know, I'll take my granddaughter here just for the walkway and the beautiful, you know, view, and they can take the boats over to, you know what I mean? It's just, it's something we didn't have here, and it's going to bring people from all around the world. And Everett will be on the map, so we're excited.
Thousands of people wrapped around the outside of the casino to be among the first players at the slot machines and table games. And at least one of them, Michael Attardo of East Boston, has mixed feelings about casinos. But if you're going to gamble, Attardo says, be smart about it.
Bet while you're ahead. No one does, you know what I mean? But chasing's the worst thing you can do. Don't do that. And take your winnings home if you can. Take them home with you.
And by chasing, you mean exactly what?
You're down, you're down, you're down, you lose. You take more money out of the bank, take more money. you remortgage your house, you come back, you lose all that, chasing your losses. It never works out.
Then Attardo cited a common refrain that applies as much in Everett as it does anywhere else. The house always wins. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simone Rios.
Award-winning Boston chef Jamie Bissonette describes himself as a late bloomer. Today, he's the chef partner of six restaurants, but his road to success wasn't exactly straightforward. In high school, Bissonette says the adults in his life didn't have high expectations for him, which almost derailed his journey before it started. He shares his story for this installment of WBUR's Lessons Learned.
When I was younger, the goal was not go to jail. That was it. I was getting in a fair amount of trouble. I was fighting a lot. I definitely had like a wicked chip on my shoulder because I had no direction. The guidance counselors put me in the class where I got to leave early. In his words, well, we've got to get you ready for the workforce because you're certainly not going to college or really going to amount to anything. So you should start learning how to pump gas or like bag groceries. Hearing things like that was really damaging, to be honest. And I was like, oh, okay, if I'm destined to go nowhere, then why should I apply myself to try to go anywhere? So I stopped listening to people at school. I stopped applying myself. And, you know, what's the lowest passing grade you could get? That was me. And then I found music. And I found punk rock and hardcore. I found people at those shows, and there was like 10 of us that were going to see punk and hardcore bands every weekend. You know, we talked about starting a band, and we did that. And I started traveling. And the one thing that you do is you have to go find somewhere to eat. We were all vegetarians and a lot of vegans. In the early 90s, it was not easy to eat in a lot of parts of the United States. So, okay, Denny's has the fried okra. The fried okra is vegetarian. We can get a side of home fries. If we ask him to do it in a pan, it won't be contaminated with all the bacon fat. And then we met a guy who was a devoted Hare Krishna. And he's like, oh, well, if you come with us, you can pray, you can meditate, and there's like a free meal in the basement. So we started doing that. And the spices that were in the dal and chana dal and the dosa and all of the chutneys blew my mind. And I started to really think about flavors and how they work together. And I fell in love with it. I stopped practicing when we had band practice. And one of my friends who was in the band, he said, you should be a cook, man. Like, you're a pretty terrible musician. And you've got a lot of energy. And he was right. The next thing you know, I was like 17 years old, got kicked out of high school. And somebody told me about a culinary school that I could get into with a GED. So I went. High school to culinary school for me wasn't comparable. Like, it was more like, going to school and then going to culinary school was like that proverbial going to church. Like, I walked in and was like, this is where I'm supposed to be. I had really great knife skills, and I was fast, and I was very clean. I showed up early every day. I stayed late. And you know, the chef instructors would tell me, you really have a knack for this. Like, you're going to be great. You just need to slow down and make sure you pay attention. In culinary school, we had to take some other classes. Like, we took an art history class, and we took public speaking classes. And I found myself doing really well in things that I was doing really poorly in high school. And it was environment. It was having people believe in me and having people say, you know, we think you're good at what you do. And I realized that was such an important part of my subconscious. Like, I needed that. So I did a lot better in school.
That's Jamie Bissonette, the chef partner of the restaurants Toro, Copa, and Little Donkey. He spoke with WBUR Edify reporter Terry Young for this edition of our Lessons Learned series. For more in the series, visit our website, the Edify page at our website, WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the trustees, presenting New Horizon by artist Doug Aitken, July 12th through 28th, thetrustees.org/New Horizon. And the reimagined 2020 Mercedes-Benz GLE with optional third-row seating and natural voice recognition. More at mbusa.com.
Just ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, how the Israelis and the Palestinians are not expected to show, as the White House this week details the economic part of its Middle East peace plan. This is WBUR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. and Iran will be the focus today when the U.N. Security Council meets in private. Linda Fasulo reports.
The closed-door Security Council meeting is expected to focus on Iran's downing of the U.S. drone, as well as the recent attacks on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. And diplomats say the U.S. is planning to provide council members with additional information from its investigation into the attacks on the tankers, which the U.S. blames on Iran and Tehran denies.
The head of Iran's navy is threatening to shoot down more U.S. drones if they invade the country's airspace. The U.S. military says the American drone shot down last week was miles outside there. A shooting in South Bend, Indiana over the weekend left one person dead and 10 others wounded. Police say they're still investigating the shooting at a pub. It came a week after a fatal police shooting in South Bend involving a white police officer and a 54-year-old man who was black. Democratic presidential candidate and South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg spoke to residents about the shootings at a town hall meeting yesterday.
There is a lot beneath the surface when it comes to trust and legitimacy around policing and race in our city.
Buttigieg is recommending the Justice Department appoint an independent investigator to examine the fatal police shooting in his city. Wall Street futures are higher this morning. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. A Lakeville, Mass. Couple is among the seven motorcyclists killed riding in New Hampshire on Friday night. Edward and Joanne Corr were part of a motorcycle club made up of Marines and their spouses. Authorities say they were driving on a two-lane highway in Randolph, New Hampshire, when they were hit by a pickup truck coming in the opposite direction. Jane Young is with the New Hampshire Attorney General's office.
I don't think any of us can understand how these families are doing. I don't think that the word devastation can begin to describe the pain and the anguish.
Four of the victims lived in New Hampshire. One was from Rhode Island. No charges have been brought against the driver of the pickup truck, who is from West Springfield, Mass. Massachusetts State Supreme Court today considers an emergency from lawyers who represent indigent defendants. Reporter Alden Bourne tells us a shortage of public defenders and private attorneys willing to represent clients without money is having consequences.
Recently, a Springfield judge ordered two defendants released from jail because they had not been provided a lawyer. The judge also ordered the state's public defender's office to provide attorneys in court every day. That office, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, is appealing that decision to the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, saying its attorneys are already overburdened. Rebecca Jacobstein filed the appeal.
In the past year, it appears that about 40 attorneys who used to be on our list of attorneys taking cases have dropped off.
Jacobstein says the hourly rates private attorneys are paid to represent indigent defendants are part of the reason there aren't enough of them. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Alden Bourne.
Fall River Mayor Jaisal Correa is apparently running for a third term in office. Correa pulled nomination papers last week. Voters authorized a recall election against Correa earlier this year, but Correa won the race, receiving the largest amount of votes out of the five candidates that ran. Correa still faces federal charges that he defrauded investors who backed an app he was creating. He's pleaded not guilty in that case. Sports: Red Sox fell to the Toronto Blue Jays 6-1 yesterday at Fenway. Tonight at Fenway, the Sox open a three-game set with the Chicago White Sox. Traffic: 290 East in Northboro. There's a crash blocking the left lane before the Solomon Pond Road exit. 93 South in Milton. There's a crash before Granite Ave. And Route 3 North is 22 minutes now from Derby Street to the Braintree split. Forecast: sunny day, highs today ranging from the mid-70s in Boston and on the coast and on the Cape and the Islands to the mid-80s inland. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 60 degrees. Tomorrow, some showers, maybe a thunderstorm, and cooler in the low 70s Tuesday. Wednesday, partly sunny, back to the low 80s. Thursday and Friday, partly sunny and in the upper 80s both days. In Boston now, temperatures inching up. We're at 71 degrees, 64 degrees in Westboro, 68 in Lawrence, and on the Cape, 68 in Hyannis at 734.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by New England Honda dealers. sponsor of WBUR Traffic Reports, presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 Honda CR-V and Pilot. Learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com. The Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org. And Trader Joe's, where new products arrive in stores weekly and new episodes of the podcast Inside Trader Joe's arrive online occasionally at Apple Podcasts and where podcasts are found. More at TraderJoe's.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Stephen Skeep. Palestinians and Israelis are not about to sit down and make peace, but many powers in the Middle East are set to meet and talk around that issue. The Trump administration will be at a summit over part of its Middle East peace plan this week in Bahrain. Palestinians are boycotting the summit, and Israeli officials were not invited. What's on the table for discussion is a multi-billion-dollar proposal to invest in the Palestinian economy. The White House unveiled Jared Kushner's plan over the weekend. NPR's Daniel Estrin has been covering the story from Jerusalem. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Steve.
What is this plan?
It's a plan to fund the Palestinians and other regional countries. $50 billion, more than half of it's for the Palestinians, the rest for the other countries. And the White House wants to upgrade Palestinian hospitals and roads and trade and create 1 million jobs for Palestinians and double their GDP. So it's this huge plan. They're calling it a kind of a Marshall Plan to give Palestinians better lives. But there's an elephant in the room here, which is what about all those big political questions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? Do the Palestinians get independence? Do they get control over their own borders? Or does Israel still maintain overall control? And when Jared Kushner was asked about this by Reuters, are you going to address these political questions now? He said this.
When we're ready. Again, that's something we've been working on now for 2 years. It's a very extensive document, something that I do think will make people look at this a little bit differently and hopefully bring people to the table to start having a discussion about how to resolve these longstanding issues. But that's a separate topic, and we'll deal with it at a later date.
Daniel, I'm getting the impression that Kushner's plan is not a peace plan. It's a sort of incentive for a peace plan. Is that the way to think about this? He's saying if the Palestinians were to make a peace plan, here's some investments that would be on the table. Is that right?
That's right. He's calling it a vision of what peace could look like if the two sides agreed to a peace plan.
And so what do the Palestinians think about that?
Well, they haven't trusted the Trump administration ever since it took all kinds of steps that have angered the Palestinians, like siding with Israel's claim to Jerusalem and cutting hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to the Palestinians. And now Palestinian officials like the president, Mahmoud Abbas, who appeared in a press conference yesterday, he said, wait, so the U.S. is first cutting all this money to us and now wants to give us money? And they're saying, you want to buy us with money instead of letting us have what we really want, which is our own state. Hmm. Abbas even called Kushner. He said, we will not be slaves or servants of Kushner. So definitely not on board with this.
What are the Israelis saying about this?
Well, the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, said we will keep an open mind about it, and he hasn't said very much more. He said that while he was giving a tour to National Security Advisor John Bolton. They were in the West Bank, in a place that Israel says it can't give up that part of the land next to Jordan for security reasons, and John Bolton supported that. So, you know, there are questions here about what kind of political reality the White House is supporting.
And just so I understand this summit in Bahrain, is this a meeting of the people who would pay for this Kushner plan were it ever to happen? Is that effectively the case?
I think that's the idea. The White House wants to invite Arab countries and investors and get feedback on the plan and to coordinate investments in the future. But, you know, a lot is unclear. First of all, is the U.S. going to be putting any money on the table? And will anyone put any money on the table if there's no political framework that's clear right now?
Daniel, thanks as always for your insights. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Jerusalem.
Later today, President Trump plans to sign an executive order aimed at the cost of prescription drugs. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith explains why this issue has been top of mind for the president since he was a candidate.
It was the night before the New Hampshire primary 2016. With snow falling outside, President Trump was giving one of his usual stem-winding campaign speeches in an arena in downtown Manchester. Then, in the midst of mocking his opponent's debate performance, he started talking about something new.
We're going to bring down the price of healthcare. We're going to bring it down big league. Big, big league.
In particular, prescription drug prices.
My friend calls me up, a great doctor. He says, you know, Donald, you're running and you're doing great and I'm so proud of you. I love to hear it. I say it again. And he said, but you know, with the medical and with the drugs, the United States, the largest purchaser, they don't negotiate price.
The idea of Medicare negotiating to reduce the price of prescription drugs had long been pitched by Democrats. But here was a Republican presidential candidate, albeit an unorthodox one, making the same populist pitch.
If we competitively bid drugs in the United States, we could save as much as $300 billion a year. Think of that. No, think of it.
His numbers were way off, but for the businessman candidate, talking about competitive bidding was on brand. A White House official tried to figure out who Trump's doctor friend was, but was unable to provide a name to NPR. Barry Bennett, an advisor to the Trump campaign in early 2016, says Trump sat down with voters out of view of the press before most of his rallies and would have gotten an earful about prescription drug prices, especially in New Hampshire.
It's one of those border states where they send people to Canada to get their prescription drugs at a cheaper price. And, you know, they see it on the news all the time and they're angry about it.
At the time Trump started talking about drug prices, outrage had been in the air for months.
Since 2008, the price pharmacies pay for an EpiPen two-pack has shot up from $100
to basically the same product it was in 2009. And yet the price has gone up.
The so-called pharma bro now being called the smirking CEO as he scoffs his way.
I probably would have raised the price higher.
High prescription drug prices are one of those rare issues where voter concern crosses party lines evenly. Molly Ann Brody heads public opinion research for the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Everybody can agree that they're too high, that they're unreasonable, and that they're a big problem, and that something needs to be done about them. And in fact, they agree on a lot of potential solutions. A lot of things that have been put out there are things that Republicans, Democrats, and independents all agree about.
She says one of the solutions that is overwhelmingly popular is having the government negotiate with drug companies to get a better price for people on Medicare. And that's exactly what Trump was pitching in his campaign. Never mind that it was out of sync with Republican orthodoxy. All the better for Trump, says Bennett, himself a longtime Republican consultant, aide, and now lobbyist.
He's totally untethered by our 40 years of protecting pharma. He heard people angry. They had a perfectly good case. And he started talking about it. And I think now is, you know, still talking about it.
2.5 years into his presidency, Trump hasn't carried out his promise to have Medicare negotiate with drug companies. And an administrative action that would tiptoe in that direction is in a holding pattern after thousands of public comments poured in. But people in the healthcare industry say Trump and his administration are putting pressure on drug companies. And Trump is once again campaigning on the issue. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Ahead on WBUR's Morning Edition, the struggle to afford prescription drugs by many here in Massachusetts. Now the forecast. Mostly warm weather this week. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
A beautiful day ahead with sunshine all day long. Temperature right around 80, but falling to the 70s along the shore with the sea breeze. Partly cloudy tonight. Either side of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, some showers and a thunderstorm are likely, especially in the afternoon. Temperatures in the lower 70s. You'll notice the humidity creeping up. Wednesday, an early shower, otherwise partly sunny, more humid, low 80s. Thursday, partly sunny, maybe a pop-up storm, mid to upper 80s. Friday, mostly sunny, very warm, 85 to 90. It will be cooler on the Cape all of those days.
In Boston now, 71 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Adelaide of Newton Center, a benchmark mind and memory community coming soon. Bridging the art of relationships with technology and programs for dementia. AdelaideNewton.com. Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, and a video conference room solution in one platform, featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at Zoom.us. And Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at Indeed.com/hire.
Now, Bostonomics Business, Boston-based General Electric is partnering with a Chinese firm, Power Construction, to build a $4 billion hydroelectric project on the border of Zimbabwe and Zambia. Bloomberg reports the plant will help with an electricity shortage caused by drought. No word yet on when it will be finished. Waltham-based AMAG Pharmaceuticals will soon begin marketing a drug aimed at boosting low sex drives in women. Federal regulators approved the treatment last week. It's the second approved treatment for increasing a woman's sex drive in the U.S. This is WBUR. The time is 7:45.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Anbaric's Renewable Energy Center at Brayton Point, transforming a coal-fired power plant into an offshore wind hub, delivering clean energy to homes, renewableenergy.center. And Plymouth Rock Assurance, providing Massachusetts and New Hampshire drivers with customized auto insurance coverage and advice from a local agent. More at plymouthrock.com.
This is WBUR. I'm Bob Oakes. A new WBUR poll finds nearly 1 in 3 Massachusetts residents who's filled a prescription in the last year has struggled to afford it, and more than 1 in 4 have skipped doses or rationed pills because of the cost. This even though the vast majority of Massachusetts residents have health insurance. WBUR's Karen Weintraub introduces us to one of those patients as we begin a week-long series called The Price of Health.
Joanne Roten actually has 2 forms of insurance, Medicare and supplemental insurance. But like 3/4 of Massachusetts residents, Roten still finds the cost of medications unreasonable.
So, I mean, it's just, I think that the drug companies are getting too big for their britches. I can say that, right? I do. I think they need to have some kind of humanity going on in there.
Roten is 73, with long white hair she pulls back in a ponytail. She's been struggling with diabetes for nearly a quarter century. She carefully tests her blood sugar 3 to 5 times a day and balances it against what she eats and how much she exercises.
When you have diabetes, it affects every organ in your body.
Right.
So you have to take care of your body.
But living on a fixed income makes it tough for Roten to afford her diabetes medication, in addition to all the other medications she takes, a cholesterol drug, pills for high blood pressure, thyroid problems and sleep issues, a daily aspirin, 2 antidepressants, and an inhaler to help her breathe. Roten drives herself to the drugstore near her Everett home pretty much every week. She's on a first-name basis with the pharmacist.
But the total for today is this much, $159.46.
So that's a good healthy feeding of my charge card, don't you think? $160. I just got done paying something on it, and I put this on, and it goes back up.
Roten is doing okay right now financially, since she inherited her ex-husband's Social Security benefits and bought that second insurance plan. But already this year, she's spent $378 for her diabetes treatment and more than $1,200 total on medications. Without insurance, today's $90 bill for insulin would have been more than $3,500.
Is that incredible? I mean, that's almost laughable, isn't it?
Price isn't the only challenge. Medicare and Roten's insurance company decide what brand of insulin she can use and what monitoring system. And sometimes they change those decisions. Roten had to adjust to both a new drug and a new blood sugar monitor in the last few years.
So they're like sort of dictating what a person can get and can't get. And you can't shop around because they got the call on it, you know what I mean?
Right.
Medicare has said these are the only ones that you can have, so that's all you can do.
It's a common problem. In a new WBUR poll, more than 1/3 of Massachusetts residents who have recently taken a medication say they've been told their insurance wouldn't cover a prescription. Roten cuts corners where she can to try to save money. She says she reuses her needles to make them last longer, but they get dull fast and then hurt going in. Roten also has saved money by getting extra supplies from friends and relatives. A neighbor gave her needle-tipped pens she uses to inject insulin.
God is so good to me. He really is. And also when my aunt died, she had some, so I got hers. And my cousin died, I got his.
Still, sometimes she rations her insulin to make it go further.
I'm supposed to take 54 units in the morning and 48 units at night. So what I might do is just take 50 in the morning and then just take, 40 at night. But then I wake up with high blood sugar, so that's not good. When you're backed up against a wall, you have to do something.
We suspect that there are a lot more that are doing it, and we don't even know.
Dr. Bob Gabe is the chief medical officer at Joslin Diabetes Center in Boston, where Roten gets her diabetes care. He says he's not sure how many of his own patients struggle to pay for insulin. It's a difficult conversation to have.
It often takes a little bravery on their part to be able to share that, because it's for many people it's a bit embarrassing to have to talk about their inability to afford things.
There's no question, he and others say, that keeping blood sugar levels stable is essential for patients' health long term.
They can reduce their risks of heart disease and stroke and blindness and kidney failure and amputations dramatically, more than 50% for sure.
That's David Nathan, who directs the Diabetes Center at the Massachusetts General Hospital and is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School.
These complications are extraordinarily expensive, both in terms of course, human terms, but also in financial terms, so that the better that we are able to prevent those complications, the better we can reduce costs overall, and human costs in particular.
This is all part of a national debate over how to make healthcare work better for patients without stifling medical innovation. Joanne Roten certainly wants to pay less at her local drugstore. She also wouldn't say no to a cure. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Karen Weintraub.
Tomorrow in our series, The Price of Health, how insulin has been getting more expensive for patients like Joanne Roten. Also, see the results of our poll on Massachusetts drug prices at our website, WBUR.org.
Social media has created new ways to connect and to sell things. Take micro-influencers, regular people paid to hype products on sites like Instagram.
We have this unique opportunity that I don't think anyone has ever had before, where we can each be our own brand.
Entrepreneurial frontier or capitalist dystopia? That story and the latest on tensions between the U.S. and Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered, today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR.
Ahead on Morning Edition, how Mark Hamill of Luke Skywalker's Star Wars fame is in his new movie role, the voice of Chucky, the murderous doll. Forecast sunny today with a few degrees of 80, cooler on the coast and on the Cape and the Islands. Showers tomorrow. In Boston now, 71 degrees.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. You know Mark Hamill as the greatest Jedi the galaxy has ever known.
I'm Luke Skywalker. I'm here to rescue you.
You're who?
I'm here to rescue you. I've got your R2 unit. I'm here with Ben Kenobi.
Ben Kenobi? Where is he?
Come on.
Luke, a beacon of hope and light, a force for good. But Mark Hamill has ventured into the dark side. He was also the voice behind this guy.
Justice is served hot, Batman! You're going to melt just like a grilled cheese sandwich!
Hamill voiced the Joker in the TV show Batman, the animated series. Outside of Star Wars, Mark Hamill has made a career out of voice acting. His latest role? A red-headed doll from a 1988 horror classic, Chucky, in the new movie Child's Play.
Over here, Andy!
Leave me alone!
Over here.
Our co-host and lifelong Star Wars fan, David Green, stopped by Mark Hamill's home in Malibu to talk about his many voices.
Well, so are you excited to play a homicidal, deranged doll?
Well, Child's Play, and Chucky in particular, has just become part of the fabric of pop culture.
Yeah, I'd say so.
I loved the original, and I remember thinking at the time, it took them 25 years to make a movie out of what was originally a Twilight Zone episode. It was called Living Doll.
Mm-hmm.
Telly Savalas played this abusive father, stepfather to, so you know he's bad already, had a daughter who got a Talkie Tina doll.
My name is Talkie Tina, and I love you very much.
Will you shut that thing off?
When she's alone with the father who hates the doll and hates the, he's just a miserable guy. I'm Talkie Tina, and I'm going to kill you in that sweet voice.
Uh-huh.
Part of it is you can sort of step out of yourself and realize how ludicrous the whole thing is. I mean, come on. A doll with a big knife. It's still scary. Well, I mean, the idea of a toy being an evil force is fascinating.
Why is it fascinating?
You know, because, I mean, I don't know. It's like, why are clowns scary to some people?
Uh-huh.
They're just such a part of your childhood. And, you know, alone at night when you're trying to go to sleep and it's on the shelf staring at you with this grin on its face.
I had that. E.T. was mine. Set on my bedstand, and I would have nightmares
about it. Of
course.
Children have imaginations, and they run wild.
So this is... this is what people call voice acting. Right. But I know some people say, why say voice? Like, this is acting.
I mean, what's
the difference?
There is no difference. I mean, to a certain extent, there might be a technical difference in that you're liberated to make choices that you would never make on camera.
Like what? What's an example
of
that?
Well, I'd never seen myself do the Joker on camera, and I was appalled. I mean, I'm, you know, pulling my hair out, and I mean, it's grotesque.
Oh, so what you're doing when you're voicing this stuff, it's like you normally wouldn't want anyone to actually see that.
Of course not.
What are you doing when you're...
In those days, I stood up because I wanted to be able to use my body because it comes through your voice if you're shaking your fist or whatever you're doing. But the actors in voiceover are some of the best I've ever worked with on screen, on television, on Broadway, off Broadway. Where I mean, they're just incredibly talented. And not only that, a lot of them have come from the world of stand-up comedy or improv, you know, Second City, Groundlings, Upright Citizens Brigade. So they're so versatile.
Uh-huh. What got you into this? Like, I mean, I know you had a lot of siblings. Like, did you act stuff out when you were... a kid?
I'll tell you, a pivotal moment was watching a Walt Disney Presents show where they, you know, Disney was very good about pulling back the curtain on how movies were made. And then there was a show where they showed how they made an animated cartoon. And then they showed Clarence Nash, this guy in a suit, at a microphone doing Donald Duck. I must have been 5 or 6 and a light bulb went off in my head. I don't know what I thought. I mean, suddenly it occurred to me, somebody gets up in the morning, goes to work, and does Donald Duck for his job. Yeah. I want that job. And I was so interested in voices that I had a little tape recorder my father gave me for my birthday. And I would record like Dracula and the Frankenstein films because I was interested in their accents. I like... listen to them, the children of the night, what music they make. I said to my father, where's that guy from? What does he talk like? I don't know. He's Dracula. He's from Dracula Land. Do your homework.
Would you study the tapes after you recorded them?
Yeah, I'd listen back and I'd try and imitate them. I mean, I was a weird kid. What other 9-year-old says things? Let me make this perfectly clear. They go, yes, that's a good Richard Nixon. Go do your homework. You sense a theme here?
Well, I'm conscious of your time. Before I let you go, I have to tell you how surreal this is. I mean, I went to see Empire with my father when I was 4 years old.
There
and it's
you
been,
are.
And shared a love.
4? That's awfully
young.
I
mean, I didn't remember it. I mean, he took me.
Yeah.
And,
well, that's pretty startling.
I mean,
I played
in my living room pretending to be you, Luke. So it's...
I never...
You probably get this a lot.
No, but I never tire of hearing these stories because people relate it to their own life. See, you related it to your father taking you to the movies.
Oh, yeah.
People come up and say, this got me through my mother's illness. This is where I met my husband online, waiting to get tickets. You know, parents tell their kids, don't talk to strangers. And then when you become known all around, it's like the whole world is your friend. And they all, like I say, they all tell me what it meant to them, how it's inspired them. And I never get bored with it. It's astonishing to me and sometimes really moving to hear how it affected their lives.
Mark Hamill, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's our co-host David Green talking with Mark Hamill. He voices Chucky in the new movie Child's Play.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Mercedes-Benz CLA, with a turbocharged engine and 7-speed dual-clutch automatic transmission. Dealer locations at mbusa.com. And AL Prime Energy Consultant, distributor of wholesale gasoline and diesel fuels for retail and commercial use, alprime.com.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
President Trump is expected to put new pressure on Iran today by imposing new sanctions. Today is Monday, June 24th. This is WBUR's Morning Edition. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Coming up, the new White House sanctions coming on Iran as tensions increase. Here's Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
My worry is that this administration has been so erratic that we could bumble into war, even if they don't intend it.
Also this hour, how Republican state senators in Oregon have gone into hiding rather than vote on a climate change bill, and why a rabbi in Brighton is asking people to bring guns to synagogue.
I'm a peaceful person. I don't want people to have guns, but I think, you know, to protect our families, it's necessity now.
Sports, Red Sox drop another to the Blue Jays. Forecast, sunny skies, around 80 today. It's 8:01. Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran are expected to dominate Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's visit this week to the Middle East. NPR's Daniela Cheslow has more.
Pompeo says he plans to talk to leaders in Saudi Arabia and the UAE about forming a coalition to counter Iran. President Trump says he came close to striking Iran last week after Tehran shot down an American drone. Trump says he called off the strike on Iran because it would have killed 150 people, but he is not ruling out future military action.
NPR's Daniela Cheslow. The UN Security Council is meeting privately today to examine recent events involving the U.S. and Iran. These include Iran's drone shootdown and recent attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. Democratic presidential candidates spent a weekend campaigning in South Carolina. NPR Susan Davis reports former Vice President Joe Biden maintains a very strong lead in early polling, but rivals are working to catch up.
22 candidates appeared at events in Columbia, South Carolina this weekend, including an annual fish fry attended by thousands of voters. Candidates also addressed party activists at the state's annual Democratic convention and appeared at a forum hosted by Planned Parenthood, where they all expressed support for expanded abortion rights. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren turned 70 on Saturday, joining Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders as the trio of candidates in their 70s. Warren is the leading candidate in the first round of the Democratic debate in Miami on Wednesday night. She's now polling behind Biden and Sanders, who will take the stage on Thursday. Susan Davis, NPR News, Washington.
Republican lawmakers in the state of Oregon are hiding. They're trying to prevent a quorum in the state house, and they're effectively blocking a vote on a climate change bill. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Dirk Vandenhart explains why they decided to leave.
What Republicans are arguing is that it's going to be very detrimental to their rural districts. So they cite things like rising fuel costs or a rise just in the cost of doing business by virtue of paying for greenhouse gas emissions. So they have been trying to do anything they can to keep this bill from passing. And that last week resulted in the very dramatic instance of them walking off. They left Thursday and have not been back since and are being fined $500 a day.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Some right-wing militia members say they're helping the GOP lawmakers, but the Oregon lawmakers say that is not true. On Saturday, the Oregon State Capitol was closed. State police warned Democratic leaders of a credible threat. President Trump says he is postponing immigration raids that were supposed to start this past weekend. NPR has learned House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged Trump to delay them. Trump says he is now giving Democrats 2 weeks to come up with changes to U.S. asylum law. He says otherwise the immigration raids will be back on. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. It appears so far things are running smoothly in Everett following the opening of the Encore Boston Harbor Casino. The Boston region's first full-scale casino had its grand opening yesterday. WBUR's Simone Rios was there.
Thousands lined up early to be among the first to experience the luxury resort casino along the Mystic River. Linda Maloney of the pro-casino group Everett Rising says the benefits of the private development go beyond the more than 5,000 jobs supported by the resort. She says it's transforming a gritty part of town that featured a much maligned chemical plant.
My father grew up down the line, which was right across the street. So, you know, when Monsanto was here and all of that, it was not nice. So this has made... We're just so happy.
Opponents of the casino argue that higher crime rates and more gambling addiction will be the prices to pay for the benefits of the new casino in Everett. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Simone Rios.
A new WBUR poll finds 76% of Massachusetts residents believe the cost of prescription drugs is unreasonable. The same poll finds 72% believe in the U.S. we pay higher drug prices than in other countries. The poll's margin of error is 3.8%. See the full poll results at our website, WBUR.org. Boston City Councilor Andrea Campbell is proposing an overhaul of the city's school system. Her plan would increase the number of high-quality schools, make registration sites easier to navigate, and update the school reassignment process. Campbell says the goal is to make the system more equitable. The aquarium station on the Tees Blue Line is back open this morning after a shooting late last night. Transit police say no one was injured when a group of young men fired at least two shots on a station platform. The station was closed for several hours. The Coast Guard is searching this morning for a missing kayaker off Nantucket. Crews first started searching for the 36-year-old man yesterday after his kayak was found empty. Both air and sea units are taking part in the search. It's 8:06.
WBUR supporters include the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect. The Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth in journalism, and women in tech.
Sports. Red Sox lost to the Toronto Blue Jays 6-1 yesterday at Fenway. Tonight, the Red Sox face the White Sox at Fenway. This afternoon in France, Team USA faces Spain in the Women's World Cup round of 16. Traffic, 93 south, a half hour from 128 to the Leverett Connector. The Mass-Pike eastbound is slow from Route 9 all the way to the seaport, and Route 3 south is 25 minutes from Lowell to 128. Now the forecast. Warm this week every day except tomorrow. Sunny today, mid-70s to mid-80s today. Coolest along the shore and on the Cape and the Islands today. Tonight right around 60 degrees and partly cloudy. Showers tomorrow, possibly a thunderstorm just in the low 70s Tuesday. Sunny in the low 80s Wednesday, then in the upper 80s and sunny both Thursday and Friday. In Boston now, 72 degrees, 67 in Natick, 67 in Methuen, 66 in Attleboro, at 8:07.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. What does the United States mean to do to Iran, given that it's not opening fire, at least for the moment? President Trump called off airstrikes after Iran shot down a U.S. drone, but the president now says the U.S. will impose new economic sanctions. And Vice President Pence alluded to further actions on CNN.
Iran should not mistake restraint for a lack of resolve. Well, all options remain on the table. Yeah. The United States is going to defend our troops and America's interests in the region.
Now on NBC, the president said he is willing to discuss the central dispute, Iran's nuclear program.
You can't have nuclear weapons. And if you want to talk about it, good. Otherwise, you can live in a shattered economy for a long time to come.
The U.S. withdrew last year from a nuclear agreement with Iran and has increased economic pressure on Iran ever since. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has been covering this story. He's in our studios. Good morning.
Good morning.
This certainly isn't over, is it?
It is not over. Look, the president's team came out this weekend united, trying to bat down any concerns that there may be, that Iran may be emboldened by the president's, you know, quote-unquote lack of action that some concerned. The president is promising strong, more crushing sanctions. And look, Bolton is, National Security Advisor John Bolton is also talking about military option is still a possibility. So there is a lot to go here. Look, some have said that pressure does work on Iran. It has in the past, arguably, but that was international pressure. This, in this case, is more a unilateral effort.
I guess we should be clear first on what we think the White House means by saying a military option is a possibility. It would seem the president has ruled out a military option in response for this drone shootdown, right? Because he said that would not be proportionate. What we're hearing from the White House is if there are more actions by Iran, that military options would be on the table. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, and then there's the question of economic sanctions. Given that the United States has already put so many economic sanctions, what more is there left to do?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's very interesting. The president promised major additional sanctions, but what can he do? That isn't really clear. The president has often talked about major things happening, and they turn out not so major, or at least not as major as we expect. One thing, though, that the president and his team want to do is they do want to give some time for the existing sanctions to take effect. There are several sanctions that were put back in place when the United States backed out of the nuclear deal. Those target energy, shipping, and the financial sector. They have had a dramatic impact on the Iranian economy and really have strangled their ability to get resources.
So I want to try to understand what the president's longer-term goal is here, Franco. We did hear him just say he's willing to talk about a new nuclear deal. But based on your reporting, is that the president's goal? I mean, there's several possible goals here. One is a new nuclear agreement. Another is regime change in Iran. Another is some kind of pretext for war with Iran. There may be other options that I could imagine. Do you feel you understand what the president's true goal is?
I mean, it's always really difficult to say what is in the president's mind. But from our reporting, certainly he is looking for a new deal, a stronger deal, a deal that was better than the one worked out by his predecessor, President Barack Obama. And he has been pushing back on some of his advisors, top advisors who have wanted stronger measures, including regime change. The president very clearly does not want to end up in another war.
And I guess we should note from this incident last week, at least based on what we were told about it, we have an example of that. There appeared to have been a consensus to go ahead and launch strikes against Iran, and it was the president who pulled back at the last moment.
Absolutely. I spoke with senior administration officials after that, and they told me that their decision, that all advisors, security advisors, and defense advisors were in support of the decision, the response decision, and it was President Trump who backed out of the deal, who made the final decision not to take action.
Is the president worried at all about looking weak?
That is an issue. Certainly all his advisors are saying that, particularly on the political stent. People like Lindsey Graham are saying you need to take steps, some type of action, or you will look like you're all talk.
Okay. Franco, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez.
We're going to look now at the problems some communities face after a natural disaster. An NPR investigation earlier this year found that money from a federal program that helps people move after disaster strikes goes disproportionately to whiter communities. Charles Lane of member station WSHU visited one Long Island community where flooding destroyed many homes and black residents were struggling to get government aid.
Horton Avenue in Riverhead, Long Island, isn't the ideal place to build a home.
I grew up, I'll show you where.
It's at the bottom of a long hill. There's a marsh on one side of the road and a duck pond on the other.
Right in there.
But that's where a dozen African-American families from Virginia settled back in the 1920s. Hobson's house was built from an old barn.
My mom bought the land for a little under $1,000, and she bought the wood for $500.
Hobson says in those days, Horton Avenue was one of the few places in Riverhead acceptable for black people to live. And like many disadvantaged communities, it was low-lying and prone to repeated flooding.
As the rain just keeps on coming.
The month of March has been brutal for most of the Northeast.
March records in parts of New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Maine.
So a lot of cleanup to be done.
March of 2010 was a month of storms, capped with 3 days of straight rain. The neighborhood of Horton Avenue turned into a lake with a dozen tiny homes sticking out.
I remember opening my back door and all the water just rushing out of the door onto my feet.
Desperate, they went through the list of federal disaster aid programs. The only one they were eligible for was a hazard mitigation grant, where the government would buy their homes and demolish them. It was their only hope, but it would be a bureaucratic morass. So she called Shirley Carverdale for help.
It was months of hammering and trying to get the attention of the media.
Carverdale is an influential community activist based out of Riverhead's First Baptist Church. To help Horton Avenue, she spent 3 months advocating for an extension to the presidential disaster declaration.
We called in every elected official that we could find, and people in FEMA and county agencies.
During that fight, Carverdale pointed out that properties in Rhode Island and a beach in the Hamptons were already on the project list.
But here was an area that was a decidedly different area. It was a poor neighborhood, and it was slipping through the cracks.
Carverdale faulted politicians and journalists from Long Island all the way to Washington for bias, overlooking Horton Avenue.
Until we called it out as racism, and that was the underpinning of it.
An NPR investigation this year found that most government buyouts of disaster-prone properties have happened in neighborhoods that are predominantly white. But FEMA adamantly denies any bias at all in how grants get distributed. In this case, the agency points to the state, which asks for the money. Ann Bink is deputy commissioner for storm recovery in New York.
Every community has the equal opportunity to apply for grants through the hazard mitigation program when funds are released by FEMA.
She, in turn, points to local towns and counties which pick the projects.
We're not targeting any community. We're targeting the best projects that mitigate risk in the future.
After all that, getting the federal disaster declaration was just the first step. Then it fell back to Hobson to work with her town to do all the paperwork and actually apply for the grant. It took a year and a half and multiple rejections. She says her neighbors couldn't handle this much bureaucracy.
People weren't speaking up. I was really speaking up for them. I would go and I would meet with them. They would tell me their desires, their wants and needs, and then I would advocate on their behalf.
In the end, the government did buy and demolish homes on Horton Avenue. Hobson and her neighbors were able to move, but
if I had to do it all over again, Linda Hobson Heath would not. But if God forced me to, then I would. I'm glad it's over, and I don't ever want to go through anything like that again.
At that time, in 2010, New York didn't have a mechanism to help disadvantaged communities, but it has since revamped its website to allow towns and counties, if they want, to highlight them. As for national solutions, FEMA says it's largely up to Congress. Since the NPR investigation, the Government Accountability Office has accepted a congressional request to look into whether disaster relief makes inequality worse. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane on Long Island in New York.
Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg faces a challenge in his day job. He is mayor of South Bend, Indiana, where he held a tense town hall meeting on Sunday. He attended with the city's police chief to discuss a white officer's fatal shooting of a black man. NPR's Scott Newman reports.
It was Father's Day when 54-year-old Eric Logan was shot and killed by Police Sergeant Ryan O'Neill in the parking lot of a South Bend apartment complex. O'Neill says that Logan had a knife and didn't respond to repeated orders to drop it. Then, he says, Logan threw the knife at him. But the officer's body camera wasn't turned on, and that's turned into suspicion. Here's Buttigieg with South Bend Police Chief Scott Roskowski fielding a question from the audience.
So if I understood your question correctly, it's about a feature where when a gun is removed from its holster, that is then that automatically activates the body camera. Is that correct?
No.
I'm sorry, I cannot hear Jordan speak if you're shouting over him. Please.
It's not the first time that race in the police department has tested Buttigieg in his tenure as South Bend's mayor. 7 years ago, he fired the city's first black police chief amid allegations that he had illegally recorded phone calls of senior white officers using racist slurs. And this weekend, there was anger over how police handled the aftermath of a shooting incident outside a bar. That troubled relationship is something that Buttigieg has acknowledged.
There is a lot beneath the surface when it comes to trust and legitimacy around policing and race in our city.
Mayor Pete, as many residents in the city refer to Buttigieg, says he will appoint an independent prosecutor in the Logan shooting case.
And I want to let you know that I agree with this recommendation as well, and that I notified the prosecutors that I would like for him to take that step.
At 37, Buttigieg has so far succeeded in standing out from the crowded field of Democratic presidential candidates. But last week's shooting in South Bend is likely to put the spotlight on his difficulty in making traction with black voters. Scott Newman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition, the dangerous, unsanitary conditions suffered by migrant children in U.S. custody in detention centers. Plus something completely different, the story of a seal researchers have taught to sing. This is WBUR.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Advanced Heart Failure Program at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cardiologists and surgeons working together to offer personalized treatments and advanced technologies for all stages of heart failure, from medical management and in-home symptom monitoring to surgical options and implantable devices. BIDMC is part of Beth Israel Lahey Health. And the reimagined 2020 Mercedes-Benz GLE with optional third-row seating and natural voice recognition. More at mbusa.com.
Now the forecast. Another warm day. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
For today, sunshine will be around 80 to 85 over inland areas, but a sea breeze keeps it in the 70s right at the coast. Tonight, partly cloudy. It's still comfortable, right around 60. Tomorrow, a few showers and a thunderstorm. Temperature in the lower 70s, but that humidity starts to creep up, and it's really with us on Wednesday. Dew points back into the 60s, a blend of clouds and sun. Temperature right into the low 80s, even some mid-80s well inland. Thursday, partly to mostly sunny skies, mid to upper 80s, and Friday, mid to upper 80s with sunshine. It will be a little cooler, Cape in the Islands.
In Boston now, 72 degrees. This is WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ophira Eisenberg, host of NPR's Ask Me Another. You might also know me as a stand-up comedian, or you may have heard a few of my stories on The Moth. Well, I'm bringing it all to Boston. Join me live this Wednesday at WBUR City Space for an evening of stand-up comedy and storytelling live. Come on, Boston, let's have a good time. Details at wbur.org/cityspace.
Support for NPR comes from WBUR and from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, N.A. Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil. Metamucil Premium Blend contains plant-based psyllium fiber, is made with natural flavors and colors, and is sweetened with stevia leaf extract. Learn more at Metamucil.com. And C3.ai. C3.ai's software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. Learn more at C3.ai.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Overcrowded, unhygienic, unsafe. Those are just some of the words being used to describe the current conditions for migrant children detained by the United States. Warren Binford is part of a team of lawyers that visited some of these border detention facilities and talked with children there. She spoke to NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro over the weekend.
Many of them are sleeping on concrete floors, including infants, toddlers, preschoolers, that they are being given nothing but instant meals, Kool-Aid and cookies to exist on, that many of them are sick. We are hearing that many of them have not been given a shower for weeks.
Advocates are concerned about the long-term impact on children's health. One of them is Dr. Julie Linton. She co-chairs the American Academy of Pediatrics Immigrant Health Special Interest Group. Thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
It's fairly obvious that living in those kinds of conditions that we've heard described for any period of time for a child is going to leave the mark of trauma. What has gone through your mind about the long-term effects as you have heard these reports?
As a pediatrician, I know that detention is dangerous for both the short and long-term health of children. And we can and must make immediate and permanent changes to the way we treat children and families when they arrive at our border in search of safety.
I mean, the needs can be so different, right, from adults. Pediatric care is a specialty because it's a population with special needs. Can you explain what these children might need that's different from their mothers or fathers right now?
Yeah, children are not just small adults, and their signs of illness can be subtle. And this is why we're urgently calling for pediatric expertise at our border with providers who can recognize the differences between a mildly ill child and a seriously ill child. For instance, children's vital sign parameters, meaning their breathing rate or their heart rate or their blood pressure, have different normal parameters than adults. And when children begin to get sick, they present with often subtle findings, and they can get sick much more quickly than adults. Mm-hmm.
And we are already hearing reports from these lawyers who visited the detention facilities. They were reporting that there are already many cases of children diagnosed with the flu. And so who knows how many others are suffering from those symptoms. I understand you've treated some of the kids who've been released from facilities like this. What was that like?
Yes, as a community pediatrician, I can assure you that the unsafe and unhealthy conditions at our border are not limited to the border. And in our communities across the country, we're seeing children who have been impacted by these negative conditions. Just recently, I saw a little girl, an infant, who was in my clinic who had been with her mom. And they were in the processing center on the border, and mom had asked a border protection agent for medical attention because the infant was sick. The response mom described to me was that the border guard gave her Tylenol and she did not have access to a doctor, and they were actually released the next day from the processing facility. And two days later, the infant was hospitalized in my community with a severe respiratory illness. The conditions in the CBP processing centers are placing children at risk for getting sick. And when children do get sick, they're at risk for getting much worse.
The Vice President, Mike Pence, spoke to CBS's Face the Nation over the weekend. And in that conversation, he was asked about these conditions that these migrant children are living in. And he blamed the situation by the fact that CPB, Customs and Border Protection, is just overwhelmed by the number of people crossing the border. Let's listen to this.
How's the executive totally powerless to do anything about these unsafe, unsanitary conditions?
Well, we're doing a lot with what the Congress has given us. But again, Congress refused to increase the bed space in the last appropriations bill.
I mean, who does have the responsibility for changing these conditions right now? Is Vice President right that there's nothing the executive branch can do?
I would actually argue that we have an urgent responsibility to make immediate and permanent changes to the way we treat family, and our current process at the U.S.-Mexico border is dangerous for the health and well-being of children. The reason conditions are worse right now is because the policies that have been and currently are being enacted by this administration, including separating families, detaining children and families for a prolonged period of time, and threatening raids that target families, are incredibly dangerous for children and families across the country.
Dr. Julie Linton, we appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
When the news is as distressing as it sometimes is, we may all need a story like this next one, the story of a singing seal. NPR's Daniela Chesler reports on the training methods of this seal, which could someday help humans.
This is the sound of a computer playing the Star Wars theme. And a gray seal named Zola. Nailed it. Researcher Amanda Stansberry trained Zola and two other gray seal pups for a year.
What's new about this research is we taught the seals how to imitate new sounds.
Stansberry says first she recorded the seals, making their natural sounds, and played those sounds back to the seals.
The seals learned that, hey, if I make the same noise back, I'm going to get a fish.
Next, Stansberry played those same sounds at higher frequencies, and eventually she strung a few of those notes together.
The first time that you hear them actually, like, imitate something recognizable back, it just blows you away.
The other two seals managed to copy vowels. Zola moved on to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker, tweeted the study, writing, "Another royalty for John Williams." Stansberry offered the composer of the Star Wars theme an unusual payoff.
The seals might be able to share some of their fish while they're out there back in the wild. That's about the only royalties that we're going to have for John Williams.
Stansberry is now a supervisor at the El Paso Zoo in Texas. She says other animals, like birds and dolphins, can also learn sounds, but seals are unique because they have vocal cords. That might bring a new hope to human speech therapy. Daniela Cheslow, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Ahead, how some of them have fled to Idaho. State senators from Oregon who left Oregon to escape from voting on a climate change bill. WBUR occasionally offers the opportunity to win prizes in conjunction with fundraising. While a pledge is always appreciated, it's not required to win a prize. Employees are not eligible. For the complete rules and all the news, go to our website, WBUR.org.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Walnut Hill School for the Arts in Natick. For student artists in grades 9 through 12, still accepting applications for fall admission. WalnutHillArts.org/admission. And New England Honda Dealers, sponsor of WBUR Traffic Reports, presenting the all-wheel drive 2019 Honda CR-V and Pilot. Learn more at HondaDealersOfNewEngland.com.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Iran is the focus today for Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He's on his way to the United Arab Emirates after holding talks in Saudi Arabia. President Trump is dismissing a UN report that calls for the FBI to investigate the slaying of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. NPR's Sasha Ingber has more.
The president says a new investigation into the death of Jamal Khashoggi is unnecessary. Last week, the Senate delivered a rebuke to Trump by rejecting plans to sell millions of dollars in weapons to the Saudis. Trump told NBC's Meet the Press that Saudi Arabia is a major customer of the United States. He says if the Saudis don't buy from the U.S., they'll go to China or Russia to purchase their weapons.
U.S. intelligence agencies concluded the Saudi crown prince ordered Khashoggi's killing last October at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The Trump administration's proposal to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census could be among today's rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court. Here's NPR's Hansi Lo Wang.
If the courts allow the Trump administration to add the question, is this person a citizen of the United States, the fight might not be over because some Democratic presidential hopefuls are calling for a redo of the 2020 census if there's a significant undercount because of the question. And in Congress, lawmakers are considering a spending bill in the House of Representatives that would not fund a citizenship question.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes in Boston. Authorities in New Hampshire say two of the seven people killed in a massive crash over the weekend are from Massachusetts. 58-year-olds Joanne and Edward Corr are from Lakeville, Mass. The New Hampshire Attorney General's office says the deaths occurred Friday night when a pickup truck hit a group of motorcyclists. On Beacon Hill, state lawmakers are examining a bill to look into creating a universal basic income in the state. Under a three-year pilot program, 100 people in three different cities or towns would be each paid $1,000 a month. At the end of the pilot, state officials would create a report based on the feasibility and effects of fully implementing a universal basic income statewide. The president of financially troubled Hampshire College in Amherst says the school will try to admit a full class next year. Here's reporter Alden Bourne.
Facing a challenging financial situation and exploring a possible merger, the Board of Hampshire voted 4 months ago to admit a much smaller incoming class for the fall of 2019. Now the college says it plans to admit a full class a year later. Hampshire Interim President Ken Rosenthal says what's changed is a significant influx of money through fundraising.
We had a target to have $7 million in cash by mid-August, and we're a little ahead of that target.
Hampshire isn't out of the woods yet. In November, it will go before the New England Commission of Higher Education and need to prove it's on solid financial footing to move forward. Otherwise, the college risks losing its accreditation. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Alden Bourne.
Sports: Red Sox starter Rick Porcello got hammered for 5 runs in 6 innings yesterday as the Sox lost to the Blue Jays 6-1 at Fenway. Red Sox host the White Sox starting tonight at Fenway. Traffic 93 South in Boston. The exit to Mass Ave is closed right now because police say a vehicle struck nearby at Mass Ave and Melnia Cass Boulevard. The westbound Ted Williams Tunnel is 20 minutes from Route 1A to the Seaport, and 128 North is 25 minutes from 95 in Canton to the Mass Pike. Forecast: sunny skies, highs today in the mid-70s in Boston and on the coast and the Cape and the Islands. It'll reach the mid-80s inland today. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 60. Tomorrow, some showers, maybe a thunderstorm in the low 70s. Wednesday, partly sunny in the low 80s. Then Thursday and Friday, partly sunny and closer to 90. In Boston now, 74 degrees, 69 in Worcester, 71 in Lowell, and 72 in Plymouth at 834.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Plymouth Rock Assurance, offering customers a ride home through their Get Home Safe program. Learn more at PlymouthRock.com. The Alzheimer's Association, working toward a vision of a world without Alzheimer's, providing care and support to all those facing the disease, with a commitment to advancing critical research. More at alz.org. And Indeed, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where employers can post jobs and use screener questions to build their short list of preferred candidates. Learn more at indeed.com/hire.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Republican state senators in Oregon are in hiding over a climate change bill that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions over time. The move left the state Senate two senators shy of a quorum, which meant they have not been able to vote the last several days. Governor Kate Brown authorized Oregon State Police to track down and return Republicans to the Capitol, which prompted a response from Republican State Senator Brian Boquist on KGW-TV.
This is what I told the superintendent. Send bachelors and come heavily armed. I'm not going to be a political prisoner in the state of Oregon.
One of the senators on the run is Tim Canope, who represents Bend, Oregon, and is on the line. Senator, welcome.
Thank you.
To the extent you're willing to say, since I guess you guys are hiding from the police, where are you?
Well, all I can say is that I'm out of the state of Oregon and the state of Idaho, and we are in a protest against House Bill 2020, which is a carbon tax bill.
Out of the state of Oregon, so do you believe you are out of the long arm of the state police?
I have been told that they know where we are, but we are out of their reach, and the governor of Idaho has said that they are not going to participate in bringing us back to Oregon.
We understand Democrats control the legislature. The Democrats have supported this climate bill that would reduce carbon emissions in the state of Oregon, as some other states, particularly California, have done. Why would you avoid the legislature to block that from passing, at least for a little while?
House Bill 2020 institutes a carbon tax, and the result of that is a massive gas tax increase of about 22 cents a gallon to start out with. It raises after that, and it raises natural gas prices by about 50% over a period of years, and it makes us uncompetitive in manufacturing jobs, and we'll lose thousands of manufacturing jobs.
People hear this, and they hear something that's basically undemocratic. There's a majority of votes for something, and you're blocking that. Why is that a good idea?
Well, actually, it's quite democratic because the Constitution allows for the fact that in order to do business, you must have a quorum. So in order to do business, you need to be working in a bipartisan way with your colleagues.
Why would you say they're not being bipartisan, though? Haven't Democrats actually considered and adopted some amendments to this measure, even if they haven't done everything you want?
They've listened, but they've adopted very little of what concerns the constituents that we care about.
They did, if I'm not mistaken, include an amendment in this bill that allows exemptions for businesses if they're using the best available technology to reduce carbon. That actually sounds like a rather large concession.
It would seem that way, but unfortunately, the effect on natural resource industries, timber and agriculture, are going to be pretty significant, and those are the districts that we represent.
Do the members of your Republican caucus in Oregon accept that there is human-caused climate change and that it is a problem?
Yeah, we've actually said very clearly that we believe that we need to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. We just said this bill is the most expensive and complicated way to go about doing that, and that's why we've sought amendments to this bill. And it appeared as though last Thursday that if we'd allowed this to come to a vote, that it was simply just going to pass. without any additional amendments to the bill.
I do have to ask, because Republicans on the national level have been so skeptical, to say the least, of climate change and climate science. Is there anything that you've done that demonstrates good faith here, that you're not just trying to find some way to block a climate measure?
Our members have drafted over 50 amendments to this bill, and very few of those of any substance were included in this bill.
How do you see this ending, Senator?
We want to make sure that it's a bipartisan, bicameral fix, and that ultimately substantial amendments to this bill are put in the bill. Otherwise, what we would request is that this be a referral and that the people of Oregon have a chance to vote on significant change in the economy in the state of Oregon.
All right. Senator, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Now to Wisconsin, where state lawmakers are rethinking that state's drunk driving laws. In particular, the part that goes easy on the first offense. Here's Corrine Hess of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's just before 6 a.m. in Madison on a 40-degree Sunday morning in March. A hodgepodge of tents and sleeping bags are set up outside a Vintage Brewing Company. About 250 people are waiting in line to buy tickets to a craft beer festival. Some, like Nick Courtney, have been camping for 24 hours.
It's a thing to do. You show up, you have some fun, you drink some beers, you grill some meat.
It's Wisconsin, after all, and some people will do just about anything for their beer. Julia Sherman works with the University of Wisconsin's Alcohol Policy Project. The group estimates, on average, Wisconsin drinkers consume 634 drinks per year, more than 25% higher than the national average.
I think that a lot of it comes from the fact that it's not specific occasions, it's almost every occasion.
Wisconsin's embrace of alcohol manifests itself in many ways. Church festivals sell beer. Parents bring alcohol-filled coolers to children's sporting events, and the state has some of the most lenient drinking and driving laws in the country. Now Republican legislators are trying to strengthen those laws, and newly elected Democratic Governor Tony Evers supports the effort. State Representative Jim Ott is leading the charge.
There's too much drunk driving in Wisconsin. Too many people are injured. Too many people are killed. Too many wrong-way drivers, too many people being smashed into.
While Wisconsin doesn't criminalize drunk driving on the first offense, neighboring states have much stricter laws. In Minnesota, a first offense is punishable by 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. In Illinois, the fine is $2,500 and up to 1 year in jail. Wisconsin's laws regulating alcohol have long favored the industries that produce and distribute it. Even in 2011, when Republicans and Democrats were at war over ending collective bargaining rights for unions, they were able to agree on a sweeping proposal to rewrite Wisconsin's beer distribution laws. Here are Democratic Senator Bob Jauch and Republican Senator Alberta Darling discussing it at a budget hearing.
But then it wouldn't be a budget without having something to do with liquor wholesalers or beer wholesalers. And it is every budget.
It is Wisconsin.
Another major player here is the 5,000-member Tavern League of Wisconsin. Republican Representative Rob Swearingen led the group before being elected.
Every one of these lawmakers has a tavern in their backyard, or a supper club, or a reception hall, or somebody that's got a liquor license.
The way alcohol has permeated Wisconsin's culture has been costly for residents. A 2013 report estimated excessive drinking cost the state nearly $7 billion in 2012. Lawmakers have tried before to strengthen Wisconsin's alcohol laws and were met with considerable resistance. But now, with support on both sides of the aisle, it could finally be last call for leniency when it comes to drinking and driving. For NPR News, I'm Corrine Hess.
This is NPR News.
This is 90.9 WBUR. Coming up on Morning Edition, an invitation to bring guns to synagogue by a rabbi in Brighton. Now the forecast. Here's WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein.
It will be tough to work today with all the sunshine out there. Temperatures in the upper 70s to low 80s. A little cooler in the afternoon right along the coast. Partly cloudy tonight, either side of 60 degrees, dry. Tomorrow, showers and some thunderstorms around the area. Temperatures only in the lower 70s. You'll feel that humidity creeping up. And it's with us on Wednesday, partly sunny. We're in the low, perhaps middle 80s, maybe a shower early. But it definitely feels like summer. Thursday and Friday, 85 to 90 degrees. Cooler Cape and the Islands, a blend of clouds and sun.
In Boston now, 74 degrees.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping public radio advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. Informed communities, essential for healthy democracy, knightfoundation.org. And WPI, which in 1970 pioneered project-based learning to give students opportunities to help solve real-world problems. Since 2015, more than 130 colleges and universities have worked with WPI to customize their own project-based approaches, including 26 just last week. Learn more at wpi.edu.
Now, Bostonomics Business. Boston-based General Electric is closing a large natural gas power plant in California 20 years early. GE tells Reuters the facility is no longer economically viable because of California's focus on wind and solar energy. The plant is expected to close by the end of this year. A Somerville company is working with a major automaker to make roads safer. Perceptive Automata is developing artificial intelligence software for Volvo trucks. Company Vice President James Gowers says its technology can determine the intent and awareness of other drivers and pedestrians and cyclists.
Basically, artificial intelligence that can scan constantly, right, 360 around the truck and look at not just a couple of pedestrians, but a broad set of pedestrians, and help the truck driver basically with situational awareness.
Gowers expects the technology to be used in self-driving cars in the future. This is WBUR. It's 8:45.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Lexus, introducing a new model, the Lexus UX, a luxury subcompact SUV available as a hybrid with all-wheel drive, now available at your local Lexus dealer. And Vertex, fueled by the needs of patients, families, and healthcare providers, Vertex invests in science to strike at the core of serious diseases. VRTX.com.
This is WBUR. Good morning. I'm Bob Oakes. A Brighton rabbi is asking his congregants to bring guns to synagogue. His remarks, he says, come in response to an uptick in attacks on houses of worship across the country. As WBUR's Jerome Campbell reports, the rabbi believes the attacks require a drastic response.
Rabbi Dan Rodkin says thoughts and prayers will not save his congregation from an attack on their house of worship. Over the past 2 years, the synagogue Rodkin leads has been improving security measures. Shallow House now has security cameras, panic buttons, and reinforced glass windows. But Rabbi Rodkin worries a gunman might still find a way to his synagogue members, and he wants them to be able to defend themselves.
We can't just think, you know, I'm just praying and, you know, God will save me. No, we need to take care of the situation ourselves.
Rodkin says he doesn't believe locks and cameras are enough after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last year. The congregation that endured the attack had prepared for an active shooter situation with drills, but 11 people still died. Then this year, a woman died in the shooting of a California synagogue. The gunman's weapon happened to jam during the attack, and an off-duty officer in the building shot back as the gunman fled.
I know it sounds horrible, you know, like, but I think it's a very logical approach for the situation we are in. You know, I'm a peaceful person. I don't want people to have guns. But I think, you know, to protect our families, you know, it's necessity now.
Now Rodkin is asking his own congregation to bring guns to worship. Several of Rodkin's synagogue members, mostly former soldiers and retired cops, are bringing weapons to services. And others are applying for gun licenses with letters of recommendation from their rabbi. Rodkin himself plans to get a gun, too, and wants to organize training for the new gun owners. Rodkin also says he doesn't think his congregation is in any immediate danger at a time when school shootings are far more common.
So I understand the impulse of this rabbi who says we want to bring more weapons into the community because we can't breathe right now.
Neil Gold is the president of the Massachusetts Board of Rabbis.
But from the perspective of what real security looks like, that doesn't look like security to me. That only looks like a recipe for future catastrophes.
Gold says Rodkin's views are not commonly held by other rabbis. But Gold can understand Rodkin's reasoning. He says recent attacks on synagogues are prompting difficult conversations about how Jews can safely live in America. A recent report from the Anti-Defamation League shows anti-Semitic incidents are increasing across the country. Just this year in Massachusetts, swastikas have been carved into students' desks, and two different Jewish houses of worship were both set ablaze in the same week. Again, Neil Gold.
What does it mean to say that in America, I'm not comfortable wearing an outward symbol of Jewish identity? What does that mean about my perspective as American? How welcome am I really in this place?
And on a deeper level, Gold says Jewish people are struggling to answer the burgeoning tension between their own safety and the spiritual tenet of openness. Rabbi Rodkin wants to respect that tenet, but says his priorities are clear.
In Judaism, life is the most, most sacred thing, you know. You know, political correctness, it's important, but not as important as life. So I think so forever it takes to, you know, to save the life, you know, it's the most important task.
One man who advises Jewish groups in safety says the call for guns in the congregation feels like a short-term solution. But Combined Jewish Philanthropy security advisor Jeremy Yeaman says he knows Rodkin is not the only rabbi talking about guns in synagogues.
Rabbis have asked me about this, and congregants have asked as well, should I have a license to carry? One of the questions I say is, have you considered and are you willing to take someone's life?
Yeaman says you might overestimate your ability to pull the trigger in an active shooter situation. You might have to go find the shooter if they are somewhere else in the building. Or the shooter could shoot you first. There's always the possibility the attack happens when you're not there. And Rabbi Rodkin says he's not certain he could act in the moment of a shooting.
This is all in God's hands, you know. I think training will help, and people who are trained, you know, will probably be better people than I personally. But again, I think you never know until you're placed in this situation.
But God willing, the rabbi hopes he never finds out. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Jerome Campbell.
Social media has created new ways to connect and to sell things. Take micro-influencers, regular people paid to hype products on sites like Instagram.
We have this unique opportunity that I don't think anyone has ever had before, where we can each be our own brand.
Entrepreneurial frontier or capitalist dystopia? That story and the latest on tensions between the U.S. and Iran this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered, today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.9 WBUR.
Boston's NPR news station. Bob Oakes here with Robin Young now, who's in to tell us about the news at noon on Here and Now. Good morning, Robin.
Morning to you. What a beautiful day it is. And we're going to be following all the news for you so you can go out and frolic. For instance, what is going to be going on in the relationship between the U.S. and Iran. We were just hearing, you know, NPR will be looking at that all day, especially since new sanctions lowered today. But also, Bob, the Supreme Court is expected to come with a decision today, and it could be the census question. You know, will we have the "Are you a citizen?" question on the census? I'm not sure if this means that the court has taken into consideration these recent documents that have been unearthed that show that this was an effort on the part of Republicans to disenfranchise those who are not Republican, people of color. And so we'll keep a close eye on that. Also, a great conversation with a bioethicist who found himself addicted to pain medication. He feels that any doctor who prescribes a pain medication should also know how to treat an addiction. And then a fascinating moment in history, 1831, Nat Turner Rebellion around this time, a violent uprising by slaves, brutally put down by whites, who then turned around and said, maybe we should end slavery. There was actually a vote in Virginia. It didn't make it, but imagine that, if we'd ended slavery in the 1800s. That and more, Here and Now.
All right, Robin Young, back at noon on Here and Now. Thanks a lot.
We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston University's Metropolitan College, offering part-time and evening accelerated degree completion. Earn an affordable bachelor's in computer science or management studies in just 2 years. Learn more at an information session Saturday, July 20th at 10:30 a.m. Sign up at bu.edu/met/info.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep with the story of people trying to avoid alcohol, which can be hard if you attend weddings or funerals or office parties or almost anything. that can involve drinking. In the last few years, a movement called Sober Living, or Sober Curious, has been gaining followers. April Fulton reports on the people who want to socialize without alcohol.
It's a Saturday night. People are enjoying a few drinks at Harvard and Stone, a popular bar in a hip Los Angeles neighborhood. A dozen women, clearly enjoying themselves, are sipping some pretty good cocktails made without alcohol.
Oh my God, I got the honeydew one. It's at the very top.
The drinks feature a brand of non-alcoholic distilled spirits called Seedlip.
All of the fun of spirits without all the liability.
Joey Bernando is the bartender.
The honeydew Collins is going to be coconut milk, a little bit of Seedlip, a little bit of lime juice, and then we top it off with fresh honeydew juice.
It's really good.
These women are part of a sober social club. There are more than 100 members, mostly 30-somethings. They work out, they have demanding jobs, and they say they feel better without alcohol. Here's Stephanie Forte.
My overall health and, like, my skin, my eyes, I lost weight. I have thyroid disease. When I quit drinking, my thyroid medication, the dosage was cut in half.
Not too long ago, a group of women not drinking alcohol at a bar would have seemed strange, but it's become more common.
Not everybody wants to get wasted when they go to the bar.
The Sober Curious movement started as a challenge for those who felt they partied a little too hard over New Year's. At first, it was dry January. Now there's dry July and even sober September. Instagram accounts like the Sober Girl Society and Sober Nation make going sober look glamorous. But many people have not had an easy road or a catchy name to describe their relationship with alcohol.
I was 23 years old when I got sober.
That's Chris Marshall from Austin, Texas. He's been sober 12 years. He started drinking in high school, got his first DUI at 16, then joined a fraternity in college and kept drinking.
All my drinking was really centered around community and wanting that connection so badly with other people.
He finally got sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. He became a counselor to help others, but found that being in recovery was often really lonely. So he created Sands Bar. It's a sober bar open on Friday nights where people can talk, listen to music, and of course, drink some good non-alcoholic drinks. On a recent Friday night, Rob Zaleski and Kim Daniel walk in. They're going without alcohol for 30 days.
We kind of came to a realization that we were drinking way too often and way too much.
They're sharing their experience on Instagram using the hashtag BoozelessATX. They've been taking archery lessons, playing flag football, and tonight, Sands Bar.
We're finding that we can fill our days, but sometimes the nights are hard. Mm-hmm. And this is a great option for us.
Sands Bar has been so popular, Marshall took it on the road this year. He organized pop-up bars in New York, D.C., and Anchorage. He's expanded into Kansas City, Missouri, and Western Massachusetts. Marshall has seen a lot of changes in the way people view sobriety. Back when he was getting sober, you either drank or you didn't. Now there's a whole spectrum.
Not everyone identifies as sober all the time.
Now, this is important. If you're drinking heavily on a regular basis, seek medical advice. But if you can experiment with cutting out alcohol, Marshall says be vocal about your plans not to drink. Bring a friend who supports you and demand a good substitute beverage. April Fulton, NPR News.
This Sober Curious movement is relatively new, and scientists are just beginning to study the health effects of taking a short break from alcohol. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey with what researchers have learned so far.
Whether it's Sober September or Dry July, pick your month, there's a handful of small studies that have evaluated what happens when people stop drinking for 30 days. Aaron White is a senior scientific advisor at the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. He's reviewed all the studies, and he points first to one published last year. Researchers in Britain compared a group of men and women who drank moderately with a group who agreed to 1 month of abstinence. Their average age was mid-40s.
And they found that at the end of that month, just after 1 month, people by and large lost some weight. They had improvements in insulin sensitivity. Their blood pressure numbers improved. Their livers looked a little healthier.
The improvements were small, but White says he didn't expect so many changes.
The findings of these studies are actually very surprising.
When it comes to changes in the liver, as part of a separate study, researchers in the Netherlands took liver measurements on a small group of people who drank, on average, about 2 drinks a day. But after a one-month break, the researchers found a measurable reduction of a compound called GGT, which is a marker of oxidative stress.
So everybody is aware that you can do some serious damage to your liver with chronic high levels of alcohol consumption. But one of the things we're learning is that even moderate levels of drinking can tax the liver.
There's also evidence that a break from alcohol can improve sleep and energy levels. And White says, at the very least, a break can help people sort of reevaluate their relationship with alcohol.
I think sometimes we're not aware of how our habits are actually affecting our lives until we take a break from them. And in the case of alcohol, I think that what seems to be happening is people take a break and they're pleasantly surprised to find that they feel better.
We should point out that this does not happen for everyone. In one study of about 850 British men and women, a 30-day break from alcohol worked for some, but
the heavier drinkers often drop out. They don't make it through the month of abstinence.
But for those who did make it through, there seemed to be a lasting impact on their drinking habits.
6 months later, long after that period of abstinence ended, about half of the people still said they were drinking less.
So for people who want to take a break, there's a lot of preliminary evidence that it can be beneficial. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from MD Anderson Cancer Center, where physicians treat all types of cancers with a team of nearly 21,000, all devoted to ending cancer and providing hope to patients. More at makingcancerhistory.com. And from Visiting Angels, professional caregivers assisting adults at home in bathing, dressing, meals, and light housework nationwide. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Learn more at 1-800-365-4189.
This is NPR News.
This is WBUR. Forecast sunny skies today, right around 80 degrees in Boston now, 74. Heads up for commuters on the Green Line. Shuttle buses are replacing trains on the D branch right now between Riverside and Reservoir because of a wire problem. Riders are being told to expect delays. No word on how long it'll last.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up today on Point, we'll have the latest in the tensions with U.S. and Iran, Jared Kushner's Middle East peace push, and the G20 readies to meet in Japan. Our global roundtable returns. Plus, Germany has a private health system like the U.S., but even the sickest patients in Germany rarely pay more than $11 for a prescription. How? That's On Point this morning from 10 to noon on 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to 90.9 WBUR FM Boston,
92.7 WBUA Tisbury,
89.1 WBUH Brewster,
streaming at WBUR.org,
and live at CitySpace, Boston's new home for public conversation.
WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.